From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actress Christine Baranski. She stars in the new sitcom Welcome to New York as the producer of a morning TV show. Baranski co-starred in the sitcom Sybil as the witty and erotic best friend. Also, dumps, landfills, islands of garbage, and other ways of dealing with tons of garbage a day. We talk with Benjamin Miller, who's just written a history of garbage in New York. He used to work for the New York City Department of Sanitation. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Chico O'Farrell's new CD, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new anthology of teen-oriented singles. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Electoral College has given George W. Bush the votes needed to make him the nation's 43rd president. Bush received 271 votes, one more than the Constitution requires. Nevada's full four electors put him over the top. The vote count won't be official until Congress approves it on January 6th. President-elect Bush said he expects there will be a lot of head-knocking and gentle arm-twisting when he presents his agenda to Congress. Bush met with congressional leaders at the Capitol. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Bush held four meetings with the House and Senate Republican and Democratic leaders. Afterwards, House Democratic leader Dick Gephardt pledged cooperation with the incoming administration.
I can tell you that we will be there coming 50% of the way, sometimes even a little further, to the middle to get things done for the people that sent us here and hired us.
But cooperation may be hard to come by on some issues. According to an aide, Gephardt told Bush that Democrats are unlikely to vote for his $1.3 trillion tax cut proposal. Bush got a similar warning from House Speaker Hastert that a big tax cut will be harder to sell than several smaller ones. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
Senator Joe Lieberman returned home to Connecticut today for the first time since the end of his bid for the vice presidency. Heather Claiborne reports from Connecticut Public Radio.
Senator Lieberman traveled the state, stopping in diners and restaurants to thank his constituents for their support. The Gore-Lieberman ticket received a strong majority of the vote in Connecticut, and Lieberman was reelected to the Senate by 64% of the vote. The senator says he's looking forward to his third term in office.
I really believe now that I'll go back to the Senate, not only with the seniority that I've built up, but maybe with a little extra clout based on my national experience.
Some of Connecticut's high-ranking Democrats had called on Lieberman to give up his Senate bid after he agreed to be Al Gore's running mate. But Lieberman's decision to stay in both races ultimately helped to split the Senate chamber 50-50. For NPR News, I'm Heather Claiborne in Hartford.
The decline in the nation's crime rate appears to be slowing down. For the first 6 months of this year, the FBI says serious crimes reported to the police went down by 0.3%. That's compared with a drop of 9.5% for the same period last year. The FBI report says the crime rate kept dropping in cities over the past 6 months, but it rose or leveled off in small towns and the suburbs. Crime actually rose by 3% in rural communities. The crime rate has been dropping for almost 9 years. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 211 points, or 2%. It closed at 10,465 in active trading. The Nasdaq lost 29 points, or 1%. This is NPR News. The upper Midwest and the Plains states got another blast of winter weather today. Minnesota never got a chance to dig out from a weekend of storms before it was hit by another blizzard. Visibility was down to less than half a mile in some parts of the state. People in Oshkosh, Wisconsin may be able to return to their homes tomorrow. They were forced out on Saturday after flames burst from a railroad boxcar full of a combustible chemical. Patty Murray reports from Wisconsin Public Radio.
141,000 pounds of sodium hydrosulfite ignited Saturday and emptied a whole neighborhood in Oshkosh. The fire burned itself out Monday morning, and now hazardous materials crews are focusing on cleanup efforts. Residents aren't being allowed back in their homes just yet. So far, workers have removed 25% of the chemical, and Oshkosh Fire Chief Tim Fran says they're steadily making progress.
We're going to be working through the night, but judging from the time we started, and the afternoon. There's a possibility that early in the morning we could be completed.
Initially, it was thought that residents would be kept out of their homes for up to 4 days. Sodium hydrosulfite is a bleaching agent used in papermaking. For NPR News, I'm Patty Murray in Oshkosh.
Billionaire newspaper magnate Randolph Hearst died today at a New York hospital. He was 85. Hearst led his family's media empire from 1973 to 1996. He was the youngest son of William Randolph Hearst, who built the giant newspaper chain. Hearst Sr. was the model for the title character of the movie Citizen Kane. Randolph Hearst was also the father of Patty Hearst, who was kidnapped by the Symbionese Liberation Army in 1974. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Christine Baranski, is starring in the new sitcom Welcome to New York and co-starring with Jim Carrey in the new movie Dr. Seuss's How the Grinch Stole Christmas. She won an Emmy Award for her role on Sybil Shepherd's sitcom Sybil as the witty and erotic best friend. She's won Tony Awards for her performances in Neil Simon's Rumors and Tom Stoppard's The Real Thing. In Welcome to New York, Baranski plays the witty, neurotic, and successful producer of a TV morning show in New York. On the first episode, the show's new weatherman has just arrived. He's from Indiana, and she's worried that he doesn't look or sound New York enough and he'll never fit in with the Manhattan elite. And looking right is all important to her. In this scene, the weatherman, played by comic Jim Gaffney, is having his first meeting in her office. She's wearing a telephone headset, and midway through their conversation, takes a phone call.
Please sit down. Everyone is really looking forward to your Garrison Keillor-esque approach to weather.
He's from Minnesota.
Who?
Garrison Keillor.
Oh, yes, I love him. How is he?
I don't actually know him.
But he's from Minnesota.
I'm from Indiana.
Oh.
Look, the reason I wanted to come in a day early is so that I could run some ideas by you.
Yes?
Like, instead of a 5-day forecast, how about a 7-day forecast?
No, I don't want to hear about it.
I'm sorry. Oh, I didn't.
No, no. No, tell him no. You were saying?
Are you... You're talking to me now?
Yes. Actually, we were talking about your jacket.
I don't think so. Remember I was talking about the 7-day forecast?
I was thinking about your jacket. Amy, can you call Jerry and see if he can squeeze in a fitting for tomorrow? We're going to get you set up.
Are you getting me clothes? I've always chosen my own wardrobe.
No, Jim, we do not want to change you. Just your clothes. Amy, maybe give your face the illusion of color.
Christine Baranski, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
You're an executive producer of Welcome to New York. Does that give you some degree of control?
Well, yes, it does. I mean, I asked for that specifically so I could protect myself. I wanted to be able to say no, that's not good enough, or that's dumb, or that's not the kind of humor I'm interested in doing, and I wanted to be heard when I said that. Fortunately, I don't feel I have to voice that control very often, because I really adore my writers. I think they're terribly smart. They have a lot of taste and style, and I love collaborating. I'm from the theater. I would say most of my career has been in the theater, and so one of the greatest joys in the profession is collaboration with other talented people. And I think being an executive producer allows you a greater degree of collaboration.
Had you had experiences on Sybil that made you think it was important to have control so that you could draw the line when you wanted to?
Yes, I didn't have. I wasn't an executive producer on Sybil, and I did question things or have difficulty with choices, and it was clearly not my place to, you know, express those concerns. I mean, I could express the concern, but I was not in a position to wield power. So in the wake of that, I did ask for that that title.
What are some of the difficulties of doing a line or doing a scene that you just don't believe in?
Yeah, you know, that is a difficulty, and I think television's a very fast, it's just such a fast medium. You know, in 5 days you have to do a show. You go to the table, you read it, they rewrite it overnight, you get a new script, you begin blocking it, they come to a run-through, they rewrite it again. You hope there are the changes that will finally kick a scene into position. But the bottom line is you've got to learn the material and go in front of cameras in 5 days. Sometimes you have a 4-day work week. Sometimes a script is almost completely rewritten. We've actually on Welcome to New York done a 3-day work week when one script was totally revamped. So I think what I'm trying to say is there's not a lot of time to agonize over it. I mean, you can question it, you can say I'm not comfortable with it, but I think it's got to get up and out there rather quickly. That's why I think it's terribly, terribly important to, from the start, align yourself with people that you trust, whose taste that you trust, whose fundamental sensibility you are in sync with.
Now, in Welcome to New York and in Sybil, you've played neurotic, kind of snobbish characters. When were you first exposed to people like that?
I love this. Well, I hate to say it, but I think when I first came to New York, I'm a Midwest girl. I mean, I consider myself like Buffalo is the beginning of the Midwest, and I'm actually from Cheektowaga, New York, which is a suburb of Buffalo, and I came to New York in 1970. I got a scholarship to Juilliard, and that was just such an amazing transition to go from an all-girls Catholic high school in Buffalo to Juilliard. So the answer to your question is certainly when I came to New York, and I don't even think I began playing these kind of characters until maybe my 30s. I would say the first real character that had that kind of hauteur that I played was Charlotte in The Real Thing. Although I had done Sunday in the Park with George, that was another haughty aristocratic character. And that was the workshop of Sunday in the Park, Stephen Sondheim, and Mike Nichols saw me in that. And then I was cast shortly thereafter in The Real Thing. And then it's sort of continued in my career. Not that I only play those characters, but I seem to play them a lot.
Well, these are characters that have money and live in a world where stature is very important. What social economic class did you grow up in?
Well, gosh, I would say we were very much middle class. Grew up in Cheektowaga. My father was...
It's a kind of industrial suburb, isn't it?
Yeah, my mother worked at a air conditioning factory called Buffalo Forge Company. My dad died when I was 8. He had worked on a Polish newspaper, but he died when I was 8. And my mother had to go back to work, and she worked at a place called Buffalo Forge. And I was something of a latchkey kid. My brother and I. She had to work very hard to support us. I got ballet lessons once a week, but that was all we could afford. I wanted to play the piano or learn the cello, and my mom said we couldn't afford, the instrument or the lessons. And I grew up with a sense that, you know, one had to work very, very hard and that money was tight. We weren't poor by any means, but we didn't have luxury. So I got into acting became my passion by the time I was about 15, 16, and then I had read about the Juilliard School. It had just opened in 1968, so I was the third class in, and I got a scholarship there and still had to live very, you know, close to the bone. Mom was working very hard to send money and try and keep me in New York during those years. So I wasn't like living the Upper East Side life until
right.
much later.
Were you exposed to much theater in Cheektowaga?
No, you know, the funny thing is my grandparents were actors in the Polish theater. there was a Polish community, you know, very large Polish community in Buffalo. And my grandfather was an actor, and my grandmother saw him on the stage and kind of fell in love with him. And then he met her and fell in love with her and wooed her when she was 16, wanted her hand in marriage, and she he had to wait until she was like 18. But they married, and they did Polish theater, and my grandmother was in operettas. I have a wonderful picture of my grandmother. She was a very vivid woman, and I lived with her. We shared a bedroom in my childhood. This is before my dad died, but we shared a room, and she's a very vivacious woman. She had a radio show in Buffalo, a comedy show she wrote with another woman, and they played two comedic characters. And so she was a writer, and after my dad died, we moved away, and I didn't live any longer with my Nana. But I think she was a huge influence on my life. And to answer your question, I didn't see a lot of plays, but I remember going to concerts. We heard Polish concerts, and my most vivid memory as a child, and I often think it's the reason I am a performer, is shortly before my dad died, I was taken to the Polish ballet, a Polish singing and dancing group called Śląsk was appearing at Klein Hans Music Hall, and I went alone with my father, and he was sitting to my right, and the concert was just filled with beautiful Polish music and dancing, and he was a great lover of Polish culture. And at the curtain call, now I'm about 7 years old, I was 7 years old. At the curtain call, my father was so overwhelmed and moved that I remember he was a very large man, very tall, very well-built man. At the curtain call, he started shouting bravo, and there were tears streaming down his face. And I was so embarrassed. I poked him, and I said, "Tatush, you know, like, stop, you know, you're embarrassing me." And it was such a moving, now in retrospect, I'm just very moved when I think of my father's, you know, love for those singers and dancers. And I often think, you know, this little girl watching her father, you know, looking up and seeing him crying and shouting bravo, I kind of went into performing, and I often, that moment resonates with me very often.
Even though you were embarrassed by him at the moment?
Yeah. I was very moved by it. And my own children, when they go to the theater with me, I also get very emotional, and I see my children poking me like, "Mom, don't embarrass us by crying, and don't shout bravo, and you're cheering too loud." But it's kind of gone full circle.
My guest is Christine Baranski. She stars in the new sitcom Welcome to New York. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Christine Baranski is my guest, and she's starring in the new sitcom Welcome to New York. Now, you went to Catholic school. Your character in Welcome to New York, and also your character in Sybil, they really like clothes. You probably had to wear a school uniform when you were going to Catholic school. What was the uniform like, and how did you feel about wearing it every day?
Oh, God, it was so dreary. I can't tell you. Every night of my life, I had to iron these white shirts. You had to wear a crisply clean ironed white shirt and this navy blue uniform that when you knelt down, the hem had to touch the floor. Those were the rules. And we had to wear nylons, and we had to wear black loafers. And that was the code. And we would, you know, iron the shirt and then iron the uniform, and, you know, by the time I graduated, my uniform was just shiny. I mean, the whole backside of it was just pure shine. But it was so dreary. Yeah, you've reminded me now of, like, those utterly dreary years of wearing a uniform.
It must have been great to be on stage and not have to wear the uniform.
Well, the joke was that we'd leave school, and after we got a block away from school, all the skirts got hiked up to mini length. You'd see all these girls teasing their hair, applying their frosted lipstick, and walking out of the school looking like sluts. But I always say Catholic girls make the most erotic women because there's so much that has to be suppressed or attempts to be suppressed that just translates into eroticism.
Now, you were the salutatorian in your high school class. That's the second in command to the valedictorian, right? So you have
you
the second highest grade in the class or something?
I don't think I had the second highest grade. I was a salutatorian because I was president of my class.
In fact,
I was president of my class, if you can believe it, for 4 years in a row, and I had been president of my class since the sixth grade.
Wow.
And I think that was not my great intelligence or even leadership skills. I think it may have been that I was rather fearless getting up in front of people and talking. And well, of course, now I'm an actress, and I fearlessly get up in front of people and talk.
Now, in at the end of your high school years, you did work with this acting workshop affiliated with the university campus, and this was in the late 60s,
yeah,
as you were saying, when things were pretty radical on the campus, the arts as well. There's a lot of avant-garde art on the campus. And I'm wondering if you got involved with avant-garde theater, and if there, like, what was the most far-out thing that you did during that period of your life, acting-wise?
I did, in my senior year, I was part of something called the Company of Man, and it performed at the old Pierce Aero Plant in Buffalo. It was this huge hangar, and it was like a warehouse. And I did a play by a man named James Cheville called The Master, and it was a two-character play. And in the play, I was being kind of indoctrinated by this older man into being what it meant to be an American. And I wore an American flag as a mini dress, and I wore this with high white boots. It was really very sexy. But what I remember most about it was being told that if the police came, I had to hide in the bathroom because it's, of course, illegal to wear an American flag, to desecrate the flag. But those were the days when, you know, people were really doing serious anti-war pieces, and there was really an avant-garde, and there was a lot of passionate talk about another kind of theater. You know, this was the Living Theater and Joe Chaykin and the Open Theater. I actually took workshops with the Open Theater. They came to the University of Buffalo, and I remember seeing Joe Chaykin and working with the Open Theater and hearing Jerzy Grotowski speak. And it was actually like my career could have gone a whole other way,
right,
except for the fact that I got into Juilliard, which was it was just very different. I mean, those years stopped for me of doing avant-garde theater. I began doing classical training, European classical training.
Now, you've also done some singing. You sang in an Encores production in New York of the Burt Bacharach musical Promises, Promises, and you performed with Martin Short in that. That was just a really delightful production.
Yeah, it really was. Mm-hmm.
And you also did a production of Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd in Los Angeles with
Kelsey Grammer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how much do you like singing on stage, and how often have you done that?
Well, I love singing on stage. I actually have studied singing for years now, and because my career has concentrated so much on acting, and I got a late start in training my voice, if you can believe it, I went to the famous Juilliard School of Music and really hardly took any singing. Did not concentrate on developing my voice at all. It wasn't until my mid-20s that I began studying singing and then discovered that I had a very rangy voice. I have like almost three octaves. I have like a high mezzo-soprano voice. And at one time, I became so enthralled with singing. I was just taking singing lessons every day and then listening to opera recordings and learning arias, and worked a lot on classical singing and studying Lieder and all. Now, nobody people don't know this because I don't actually get up and sing opera or Lieder, but it's been an ongoing passion of mine, this kind of singing. And right before I did Sweeney Todd, right before I was asked to do Sweeney Todd a few years ago, Skitch Henderson asked if I would be the guest soloist for the New York Pops opening night concert. And he said, you can sing anything you want. And I actually did get up and sing the Seguidilla. And I sang a beautiful foré piece. And it was just a thrill. I mean, standing with an orchestra and singing, doing this kind of singing that I'd always considered so much a part of my life, but never really got much expressed, you know? And then it was great to have that kind of training as I began work on Sweeney Todd, because I think you really need a very well-trained voice to sing that score.
One last question. I understand that you were at the canonization of Mother Catherine Drexel.
Yes.
And is it right that your husband is a distant relation?
Well, not that distant, actually. She's a first cousin twice removed.
Wow.
He remembers her from his childhood as Cousin Kathy at his grandma's house. His grandmother was a Drexel. His grandfather, great-grandfather was Joseph Drexel, and that was the brother of Anthony Drexel. And Catherine was a niece of Anthony, and she founded this religious order called the Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament, gave her entire inheritance over to Native and African Americans out west, and established schools and hospitals. And she was canonized, and we were in Rome in October with many members of the Drexel family. And yeah, we were outside in St. Peter's Square. It was quite amazing. I mean, I was sitting next to my husband, who said, "Wow, Cousin Kathy." I was like, "Wow, it's pretty amazing."
Oh, that is. I'm sure everybody in the Catholic school you went to would have been mighty impressed.
Yes, those nuns, they would have been a little easier on me had they known I was married to a relative of a saint.
Really? Well, Christine Baranski, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was lovely. Thank you so much.
Christine Baranski is starring in the CBS sitcom Welcome to New York. She also co-stars in the new movie Dr. Seuss's How the Grinch Stole Christmas. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what to do with tons of garbage a day. We talk with Benjamin Miller, author of A New History of Garbage in New York. Also, reviews of a new anthology of teen-oriented singles and a new CD by Chico O'Farrell. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Remember those compilations of hit singles that used to be sold on late-night television by companies like KTEL? Our rock critic Ken Tucker has noticed that what used to be considered the bargain basement of the pop world has become a product that now zooms to the top of the charts. Here's his review of a collection of current hit singles called Now That's What I Call Music.
Ladies, leave your man at home. The club is full of ballers and their pockets full grown. And all you fellas, leave your girl with her friends. Cause it's 11:30 and the club is jumping, jumping. We say you gotta go.
Recently, a collection of the Beatles' number one hit singles, a collection called With Numbing Unimaginativeness, One, debuted at, what else, number one on the Billboard pop chart. The number two debut album that week was a collection called Now That's What I Call Music, Five, a gathering of some teen-oriented hit singles, and the fifth such collection to become an instant hit. The CD includes music from acts as various as the Backstreet Boys, John Bon Jovi, and Janet Jackson, who, by the way, when I wasn't looking, dropped her last name and just goes by the name Janet now. Who does she think she is? Cher? And why does becoming Cher suddenly seem like a sensible goal for a floundering singer like Janet? Why are these devilishly eclectic anthologies so popular right now? I think it's because they fulfill an old pop culture need that rock radio stations no longer provide the current generation of teens. They're the CD version of Top 40 radio. You may remember Top 40. It was the place where, in any given half hour, you could hear the Temptations, followed by the Rolling Stones, followed by the Carpenters. This was the time before the era of advertising demographics, slicing and dicing the audience into stations that specialized in only one kind of music, hard rock, alternative, urban, MOR. It's obvious to me that kids still crave that kind of variety, and they get it on these collections.
I close my eyes when it gets too sad. I think thoughts that I know are bad. Close my eyes and I count to 10. Hope it's over when I open them. I want the things that I had before, like a Star Wars poster on my bedroom door. I wish I could count to 10. Make everything be wonderful again. Hold my mom and I hold my dad. We'll figure out why they get so mad. Hear them scream, I hear them fight. They say bad words and make me wanna cry. Close my eyes when I go to bed at night. Dream adventures will make me smile. I feel better when I hear them say everything will be wonderful someday.
That's Everclear, a white rock band whose average member is probably twice as old as Britney Spears, who is also represented here. To me, there's a lot of good, catchy songs on this collection, with one terrific piece of music by the rapper called Mystical. The song here is an edited, cleaned-up version of a more profane lyric, but that doesn't stop it from being the best James Brown ripoff I've heard in a long time. Great rhythm wedded to a great vocal. Mystical offers young listeners the very definition of what their elders call the grain of the voice. Now that's what I call music.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. Coming up, what to do with tons of garbage a day. This is Fresh Air. The biggest landfill in the U.S. will soon be closed to more garbage. Freshkills Landfill on Staten Island will close next year, and New York City will be shipping tons of garbage to other states through a network of stations, barges, trucks, and trains. My guest Benjamin Miller is glad this isn't his headache. He's the former director of policy planning for the New York City Department of Sanitation. Miller has studied many of the garbage headaches of the past. He's written a new book called Fat of the Land, A History of New York Garbage Over the Past 200 Years. I asked him to describe some of the most smelly and offensive ways New York dealt with garbage in the past.
Well, I suppose those operations, those colorful operations that took place on islands around the city, humans, men, women, and children would pick through the stuff to pull out anything that might be saleable, bits of buttons and glass and so on, and the rest was taken inside and cooked up into huge vats with naphtha or kerosene or water and turned into grease and nitroglycerin and fertilizer. And these processes were very odorous indeed.
What islands are you referring to?
Well, this all began on an island called South Brother, right between Brooklyn and Queens in 1849. The city inspector at the time, whose idea it was to take the garbage out of the city for the first time, he was trying to deal with an epidemic of cholera and form this company, which he was a secret silent partner. Obviously, it would have been illegal for him to be involved. And in fact, he invented what I consider the modern waste management model, which is to say, deciding for the first time that garbage had to be removed from the city, designating the place that it would be taken, saying that it had to go to one firm, saying that it was illegal for anybody else to scavenge the garbage that was on the streets, and then paying this firm an enormous price. All of that he invented in 1849 on a little island called South Brother, and they would take the garbage up there in barges and dump it on the shore and feed it to hundreds of hogs that were there and boil up the bones and so on.
Now, what about the river, the East River and the Hudson River? What are some of the things that were just dumped into the river?
Well, everything was dumped into the river at the start of the city, just as it was in most cities around the world. The East River was the first problem because it's a relatively narrow river. The channel, the currents are pretty rapid as it is, and it was the most important river for commerce. That's where the South Street Seaport was, where these sailing vessels would tie up, and it was really messing up the maritime economy. So the first laws against waste disposal were to protect the East River.
You describe how bloody entrails, I guess, from butchers and meat packing plants were dumped into the river, and it got so bad it impeded navigation. That sounds pretty ugly.
Yes, that's exactly what was going on in the East River, and that's why it was outlawed from the 1850s on. But Inspector White in 1849 had the notion to forbid this stuff from being disposed of in the city. Until then, people had boiled it up. They're called bone boilers nuisances, and there were vats all over the city and manure piles and so on where people sort of cooked it up and fed it to hogs and dealt with it right there. It was White in 1849. He said, we cannot have this going on in the city. I'll take care of it. And that's when we started dumping it in. He was hauling it away in barges, but he was being paid so much that it became he just sort of lost interest in hauling all of it away to South Brother Island and later Barren Island. So at that point, he encouraged people just to throw it into the river. So he was really making the problem that he was trying to solve worse.
What do you think some of the historically smelliest parts of New York City were?
Well, South Brother Island was smelly for the couple of years that it lasted, but that operation was sent down to Barren Island, a little island around the corner from Coney Island at the mouth of Jamaica Bay. That's where Inspector White took his company after they were thrown off South Brother Island. And that island was the main repository for the city's trash from 1852 until 1916. That was an amazing place. Hundreds of people lived there. Thousands of hogs lived there. There were all sorts of factories in which this stuff was taken and cooked up after humans had sorted through it to take out, as I said, anything saleable. And these smells created problems for the neighbors for decades.
So on Barren Island, the people who worked with dealing with the trash actually had to live on the island with the trash?
Absolutely, and they lived there for generations. There were literally generations born and died on the island, and those people very rarely got off the island. Many of them came straight from Ellis Island to Barren Island, the way these urban ethnic opportunity niches often work. And Barren Island was an amazing place because it had Slavs and Italians right off the boat from Ellis Island and African Americans. It must have been one of the most mixed populations around.
I know when I was a kid and driving, say, from Brooklyn to Queens through the Belt Parkway and other parkways, there were periods, there were parts of the ride where you'd pass landfills and it would just stink. And there'd be like seagulls flying overhead. And I used to think that seagulls were birds that ate trash. I had no idea they were even connected to the sea. I thought these were the birds that liked trash because there would always be seagulls by the landfill near the ocean.
That's absolutely right. The Belt Parkway is extended past some magnificent large landfills that Robert Moses created, and he, in fact, landfilled almost everything along the Belt Parkway.
So what kind of vermin did these landfills attract?
Well, seagulls certainly are landfill birds. I have a friend who's friends who are naturalists, and they made a film about Roger Torrey Peterson, and they reenacted a trip that he had taken to Maine in the 20s to see a seagull colony. He thought it might be the last colony in the eastern seaboard and thought they might be becoming almost extinct. They certainly bounced back thanks to Freshkills.
Freshkills is a huge landfill. Are landfills still commonly used in New York, or is that more or less going out of style?
Well, from now on, they're illegal in New York City. The Freshkills landfill must close, according to state law, on the last day of 2001. Landfills nationally, however, are increasingly used as a waste disposal method.
Now, you mentioned this Freshkills landfill. There's, what, 13,000 tons of raw garbage deposited every day in this landfill, which is located in Staten Island?
Well, yes, that is to say, it's no longer 13,000 tons a day because the city is gradually weaning itself off. So I think something only like 3,000 tons is going there right now. But until the last couple of years when the Giuliani administration started to turn off the spigot, it was 13,000 tons a day. In fact, before then, it had been much more in the 20,000s.
What are the incentives for another city to take New York City's trash?
Well, the proposal right now, it hasn't been adopted, it hasn't been finally approved by the state of New Jersey, is to build a massive transfer station in Linden, New Jersey, which is literally an infield fly away from Freshkills across this little creek called the Arthur Kill that separates Staten Island from New Jersey. If that plan, has been approved by the city, if it's approved on the New Jersey side, that will probably become the largest waste transfer station in the world. Garbage will be taken from barges delivered from New York, put onto rail cars, and hauled somewhere, who knows where. The city of Linden, in return for that, will get a significant amount of money. The estimates range between a couple of million and $5 million a year as a host fee.
How did you get into the sanitation business in the first place?
Probably a strange route. I started as a graduate student in urban ecological anthropology. I was interested in the planning process and what that revealed about class relations and power structures in our society. And I was interested in finding, for a dissertation topic, an infrastructural planning process that I could really observe from the inside. And instead of going off to Samoa or someplace like that to do my field work, I took a job in the sanitation department.
How was trash dealt with when you were a kid? What are some of the things you remember about trash from your childhood that's really different from how it's dealt with now?
Well, I grew up in the Midwest where there were town dumps and you could take your stuff out there and throw the stuff away and see rats and so on. You really disposed of it yourself, quite different from our experience where very few people have ever been to Freshkills out in Staten Island.
Have you been there?
Oh, sure.
Describe what it's like. This is the dump where there used to be 13,000 tons a day of trash.
Right. It's a 3,000-acre landfill, the largest landfill in the world in terms of size, in terms of the amount of garbage that's there. And it's the sixth biggest landfill in the country in terms of its remaining space. It looks like mountains. The tallest peak is about 170 feet high, which, of course, is a fraction of what it was originally planned to be. The peaks were planned about 10 years ago to be as high as 500 feet, which would have made them as high as Mount Cadillac, practically, or certainly the highest point south of Mount Cadillac. The smell varies a bit, but it's been largely exaggerated. Of course, I'm not a Staten Islander. I haven't lived around it year-round. And of course, it depends on which way the wind is blowing. So, and there are lots of smells out in that part of the world, partly because of things blowing across the river from New Jersey. There are lots of chemical plants and so on. So all of the smells can't be blamed on the landfill. It's covered every day, the garbage that is dumped there, with clean dirt. Because it's such a large landfill, houses are not as close as they might otherwise be to it. The parts of the landfill that are closed are covered. They look like mountains. They look like unnatural mountains. You would immediately spot them as you spot any landfill of that size, of any size across the country. They're planted with wild grasses and small trees and so on. So they look like hills with grass blowing on them.
When you're filling in land with garbage and then building on that land, what do you have to do to the garbage to make it solid enough that you could actually build on it?
You can't really build on it. In the past, a lot of Manhattan and the other boroughs is made out of garbage, but that garbage is very different from the stuff we've been generating for the last half century. In the old days, a great proportion of what was called garbage came in dust bins or ash bins. It was coal ash. We didn't have oil, so everything was coal, and that was a big part of the garbage. There's also street sweepings. Manure was on the street because we didn't have cars, and that stuff was, you know, straight organic. So you mix that stuff with ashes, and you can put it down, and you can build on that sort of thing after a few years, which is exactly what was done around the turn of the century. From the 30s on, we have not been able to build successfully on garbage. LaGuardia Airport is made out of garbage, and it settles to this day. It has produced major problems over the years with buildings cracking, with runways cracking, with rats thriving so much that planes had to come back for emergency landings because rats were running down the aisles. You cannot build on garbage.
So if you can't build on modern garbage, what happens to the Freshkills landfill in Staten Island?
No one is ever going to, or in the foreseeable future, no one will be building any buildings on Freshkills. Of course, you could sink piles hundreds of feet down if you wanted to, but that's not realistic. Freshkills will be something that you can walk on someday, perhaps 30 years from now when it's all safely closed. We're just not able to build on landfill. In Tokyo Bay, the Japanese built a landfill of garbage that they're very proud of. I walked on it. They've made a golf course out of it. It's the only golf course in the world that doesn't allow smoking to prevent inadvertent holes in one. Methane coming up from it make it unusable for a smoking golf course, much less building something on.
You know, you've written this book on a history of trash in New York. What would you like us to be thinking about regarding trash and the place of trash in our lives and what we do with our trash?
Well, I would like people in New York to give some thought to where their trash is going. Just because there will be no more landfilling or incineration in New York City doesn't mean that our environment will necessarily be better from a global perspective, because the stuff is just going to be landfilled or perhaps incinerated somewhere else. And I'd like us to be a little more conscious about how that stuff is being handled and try to take some more responsibility for it.
Do you worry about there coming a time eventually when there'll be no place left to put the trash?
No, I don't think that's going to happen. Certainly, we have a lot of land in this country, if that's the way we care to fill it up. I just think that it's going to be very expensive for us, certainly expensive from an environmental perspective one day. But for the city of New York, I think what we have just started to do is going to be very expensive as time goes on, because of the way the solid waste management industry is structured, the fact that the city no longer has any control. I think this is a decision that we will regret very much a generation or two from now, when we're paying a great deal just to get rid of our garbage.
Now that you've written your history of trash in New York, do you see parts of the city differently? Are there things you notice that you wouldn't have noticed before?
Well, I suppose what strikes me most is as I walk over places that I know are landfills or were landfills. For instance, what's called the municipal section downtown, where all of the courthouses are, is on top of and right next to a huge pond that used to be called the Collect Pond, which has all been filled in. So I have a sense of where streams used to be. I have a sense of shorelines that were not there. Everything in Manhattan, lower Manhattan, that is west of 10th Avenue, for example, is landfill. I have a sense of who put the stuff there and when, for what purpose. So I suppose that's the greatest sense I have as I'm exploring parts of New York, to know that they weren't really there before.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Benjamin Miller is the author of the new book, Fat of the Land, Garbage of New York, The Last 200 Years. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Chico O'Farrell's new CD. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ Composer Chico O'Farrell comes from Havana, where he started mixing jazz and Latin music around 1945. Soon after, he moved to New York and was quickly tapped to write Latin and non-Latin material for such band leaders as Machito, Benny Goodman, and Stan Kenton. Later, O'Farrell went back to Cuba, then settled in Mexico for a few years before returning to the States to arrange LPs for Count Basie, Dizzy Gillespie, and Gatto Barbieri, among others. In the mid-90s, he began leading his Afro-Cuban jazz big band in New York and returned to making records. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews his new CD.
That's Carambola, the title track of Chico O'Farrell's new CD on Milestone. His mambos and cha-cha-chas are straight out of the 1950s golden age of Afro-Cuban jazz. The style was an early instance of world music, if we take that to mean self-consciously grafting the sounds of different cultures together. The jazz big band framework is hard to miss, but the style also has roots in traditional Cuban rumba ensembles, with their shouted vocals, rough harmonies, and polyrhythmic drumming recalling West Africa. Listen for a second to the rumba group Los Muñequitos de Matanzas. For the stylized big band version, composers like Chico O'Farrell would stretch the melody lines to exploit the horn's greater melodic and dynamic range, and would substitute an improvising soloist for a lead singer. But the basic feel can be similar. Trumpeter Michael Mossman on Chico O'Farrell's Aztec Suite. When O'Farrell arrived from Havana in 1948, Latin jazz was already brewing in New York, thanks to musicians like Machito, Mario Bauza, and Dizzy Gillespie. O'Farrell just missed being a founder of the style, but he did design a few of its monuments. His new album includes a revival of his Afro-Cuban Jazz Suite, recorded in 1950 by Machito's orchestra with Charlie Parker as a soloist. The alto saxophonist here is Mario Rivera. You can really hear that this is Chico O'Farrell's working band. They play Sundays at New York's Birdland, under the supervision of the composer's son, pianist Arturo O'Farrell. On his CD Carambola, Chico O'Farrell doesn't limit himself to classic Afro-Cuban fireworks. He sets one Havana standard as if it were a late Ellington Latin ballad, and includes a parody of 1920s jazz that sounds like his nightmare of music devoid of Latin accents. O'Farrell has often written pieces outside the classic style, but since he's a direct link to that music's heyday, he's wise to revisit his glorious past. For one thing, it lets him pass on its secrets to the musicians who populate his band and who hang on his every note.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Carambola by Chico O'Farrell on the Milestone label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today was Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from the Dial Press, publisher of Letters of the Century, edited by Lisa Grunwald and Stephen Adler, a collection of over 400 letters from famous figures and ordinary citizens chronicling our country's history. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Robert Smigel, creator of the puppet Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, and the Saturday Night Live cartoons Ex-Presidents and the Ambiguously Gay Duo. Smigel has a new series on Comedy Central called TV Funhouse. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.